Welcome to today's edition of the podcast. I'm John Burke, Managing Editor of NPM. Joining me today is Brian Halperin, Partner and Managing Director at Tax Credit Specialist, Foss & Co. Thanks for joining the program, Brian.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So we'll next be able to see Brian speak at NPM's Distributed Generation Conference on October 11th, where he'll serve on a panel discussing some of the ramifications of the Inflation Reduction Act on the community solar space. But first, Brian stopped by to give us some of his own observations on the growing intersection of community solar development and the tax equity market and how all of the DG space also might benefit. So Brian, to kick us off, maybe give us a broader overview on what some of the major implications will be from the IRA in terms of community solar growth.
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So we, you know, prior to the IRA, we were already, you know, had closed on and were in closing on some large portfolios of community solar projects. So the most immediate impact that we saw was just in the pipelines of projects we had already been looking at, we saw the tax credit amounts that many of those projects qualified for increase significantly. You know, some of these projects qualified for some of the adders. So they were eligible for more than just 30% credits. And then, you know, some of them were small enough that they could include their interconnect costs. And, you know, there was a number of factors that came together to help, really increase the amount of tax credits on these projects. And so all that combined, you know, we saw some of these portfolios that we were looking at nearly, you know, double in size in terms of the amount of tax credits they were qualifying for. Relative to pre-IRA, where some of them might have only been a 22 or 26% ITC, now they were, you know, 40 or even 50% ITCs plus interconnect. So that made a, you know, pretty immediate impact. And it also, you know, there's a number of projects that some of these developers had been sitting on that, you know, maybe were not penciling pre-IRA any longer. Suddenly they did. And so, you know, they were adding additional projects into these portfolios. Of course, there's, you know, it wasn't all just, you know, pure benefits. I mean, there was some headwinds as well with, you know, costs of debt and, you know, tariff issues and other things developers were facing, but it certainly went a long way, I think, in you know, helping to offset some of those challenges and has led to some, you know, significant growth from what we can see in the community solar market.
So when we talk about the broader story of community solar growth, you know, there's been a very robust programs that have been around for more than a couple of years at this point. There's been a permanent program issued in New Jersey this year, along with New Mexico and Illinois Shines being a big driver in Illinois. And then people get concerned about what comes next, not for lack of trying. There's legislation across the Midwest as well as Pennsylvania. But, you know, nothing yet other than, you know, state senators and congressmen trying to get community solar across the finish line. So, in effect, there is people concerned about how, you know, while the IRA does make community solar more affordable, there is some concern about how expansive this growth is going to get. But just wanted to get your sense about the broader policy overview, is if the shields are going to get let down at some point here, or there's just too much opposition at this point between utilities and politics and everything like that.
Yeah, you know, I think there's still certainly some opposition, and, you know, we could talk about some of the specific states and what's going on, but on a broad basis, I think it will help. You know, there's the states that were, you know, most, I guess, opposed or had some opposition parties within the mix are, you know, also now looking at what they're leaving on the table by not participating, and all the potential additional funding that could be coming to their state through some of these programs that came out of the IRA. So, you know, obviously the kind of direct benefits to community solar with enhancements to the tax credits. But there's also, you know, some significant funding that came through the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. And, you know, some of that is earmarked, like the Solar for All is like a $7 billion, essentially war chest of that can be allocated out to some of these programs and helping administer and ramp up capacity for some of these programs. But I think, you know, the states are looking at all this funding, and that might change the calculus a bit in some cases for, you know, whether they want to make this a priority and try to push it forward. There are some states, I think, that are, you know, making significant progress. It's just, it's a challenge, I guess, working through the legislatures and getting this enabled on a state by state basis. And, you know, that can be slow. So, we may not see things happen as quickly as we'd like, but hopefully we'll see some additional states opening up. And for some of the states that recently opened up, we'll see, you know, programs actually kind of get codified and come online.
So let's take a step back and talk about community solar's relationship with tax equity prior to the Inflation Reduction Act. I wanted to really just get a sense there about some of the diligencing you guys would do, just in the sense, obviously, you're not exploring one big utility scale project, but likely looking at a portfolio of smaller projects. You know, how that dynamic worked and, whether the IRA is going to change things or still going to require, you know, maybe even further diligencing, if this continues to grow the space.
Sure. Yeah. So, when we were first ramping up our kind of standalone renewables division within FOSS, 4 or 5 years ago, we looked at community solar as a segment within renewables that we felt was, you know, somewhat underserved by the tax equity markets. And at the time, you know, there's a lot of the traditional tax equity investors that didn't want to do community solar. Those few that were doing it had sort of draconian underwriting requirements around requiring FICO checks on all the subscribers that were going into the pool and underwriting to certain, you know, FICO score minimums and averages. And, you know, it made it difficult for developers and sponsors to get the subscribers for their projects. And then it also created, kind of an unintentional, hurdle, I think, for some of the, you know, constituents that we really want to be able to benefit from these projects from participating. So if you were, you know, low income family that, you know, statistically probably had a lower FICO score, it was more difficult to participate. Then, but setting aside kind of the impact reasons for wanting to open this up, I mean, just from a pure risk perspective, when we looked at it, we didn't really think it made sense that FICO scores would be the, you know, indicator for whether or not someone's going to pay their utility bill. It's not really what it was designed for. And, you know, there's not really evidence that it's a great indicator of that. So when we were getting involved, we decided to, you know, take a different approach and, you know, look at this. I think, you know, if you're a bank and you're used to looking at FICO scores, you know, kind of like you have a hammer and everything looks like a nail. And so we wanted to come at it, you know, with a little more thought through and nuanced process to assess the risk. So our approach was really to look at each, you know, state's community solar program, really dig in and understand those programs, what the risks were, and then run, various downside scenarios to, you know, see how the tax equity returns would hold up, you know, in certain different scenarios, like higher than expected subscriber churn, and then come at it with, you know, I think a more sophisticated analysis of the risk. And that, you know, we were able to show our analysis there and get investors comfortable and start bringing investors into this community solar market while giving developers a little more flexibility on how they went about putting together their subscriber pool. And I think it actually benefited the projects, because if you're, you know, you're trying to, the goal is to keep the project subscribed. And so if you're removing hurdles from being able to add subscribers to the project or replace subscribers, ultimately, you know, hopefully that leads to better performance of the project itself. So we saw some good success there. I think it, with the, you know, with IRA and the evolution here, you know, there is some new complications. So a lot of these projects, for example, have ambitions of qualifying for some of the adders. And, you know, the energy community adder, it's pretty straightforward. And at this point, we're pretty comfortable assessing on the front end whether a project qualifies for that or not. The other ones are a little more complicated. So domestic content, we haven't seen pop up a lot yet, but, you know, I think we'll start to see it more and more. And, you know, the analysis there is a little more complicated to you know, make it figure out if a project qualifies or not on the front end. And then perhaps the most challenging is the low income adder, the LMI adder, which, you know, a lot of these projects hypothetically could qualify for, but unfortunately it's sort of a lottery system potentially that, you know, they're going to have to apply, and we don't know, you know, what the chances of a project qualifying are. So we're going to have to likely, you know, go through a financial closing, you know, assuming they don't get the adder, but leave the flexibility in there to absorb those additional credits if they do end up getting it. But it would have been, you know, I think easier for sponsors and developers if they could have known going in if they were qualifying for that adder, that, you know, it's going to be more difficult for them to take advantage of those benefits the way it was set up. And then we also have, you know, things like prevailing wage and apprenticeship requirements that, you know, the whole industry is going to have to work on figuring out. So there is some additional, you know, diligence that has to be worked through. But I think as a category, you know, we're still really excited about community solar. We've seen it performing really well on the portfolios we've done so far. And, you know, I think it's a good place for a lot of these new investors that are entering the market to, you know, potentially participate.
Why do you think the IRS chose to do it this way with the lottery system for LMI?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, if you were to just say, set it based on census tracts or something like that, and, you know, maybe you have situations where census tracts weren't updated recently enough, and, you know, you're not really getting the directed impact that you were looking for. So I think they're wanting to, you know, get an application and more information and try to direct the funds in a more impactful way. But, you know, it's kind of like the new markets tax credit, where the government set up this, you know, very complicated tax credit structure that, you know, it just ends up creating inefficiencies. I mean, those projects still get done, but it's just, you know, it's so much more challenging to go through that kind of a process. And so, you know, I guess I wish it would have been more like the energy community adder, where we could know on the front end if a project's qualifying. I think that would have, you know, then allowed developers to borrow against it and reduce their cost of capital, et cetera. So, you know, it's nice to have it, but it does, you know, limit its how useful it's going to be.
And obviously with domestic production, we're still waiting for final guidance there. Although on the surface, we read plenty about new plans for modular expansion all over the place at this point. So there'll be plenty of opportunities, you know, going forward, depending on the timing of these projects.
Yeah, I think the challenge on that one, you know, is going to be the sourcing. And then in terms of actual, like, diligencing it, though, like, what amount of information do we need for, you know, our attorneys to be comfortable to issue a tax opinion that yes, this qualifies? And will we have that level of information from manufacturers? Are they going to be comfortable sharing, you know, enough cost information, et cetera, for us to really verify that something qualifies? Or are we just going to be asked to rely on, like, a rep from the manufacturer that yes, this qualifies? And I think if it's the latter, there's probably some investors that won't be comfortable with that. I mean, I think, you know, tax insurance can play a role there in helping to cover that risk. But, you know, tax equity investors are historically some of the most conservative investors out there. And so I think the insurance alone probably doesn't do it for some of them.
That's very interesting to hear. So let's talk about transferability, which I think seems to be among the real highlights of the IRA at this point, because there was a tax equity market. It was $20 billion, and it seemed to really favor bigger projects for the most part. That soaked up the capacity, as well as some community solar portfolio deals. But there was a feeling that transferability would help fund the rest, so to speak. Some newer technologies like standalone storage. I think when it came to DG, you know, there was a thought that some of the smaller developers, whether in community solar or other parts of the world, like CNI, or even microgrids, you know, might benefit as well because of the ease of transferability, no longer the long wait time associated with setting up these tax equity partnerships and what they may favor, and of course the expansion of the market. But what do you believe the ultimate benefits of transferability are going to be? You know, and I think just with really a focus on these smaller developers in general. Mm-hmm. And do you think, I mean, again, that there's people implying that it'll spread to other sectors, but you know, we'd really like to get your take on how you view the rest of the distributed generation sector and where or what, why or why not will they benefit from this?
Yeah, sure. So, well, I think, you know, one benefit is just bringing some additional capital into the market. I think there's investors that historically didn't do tax equity transactions, you know, like through a partnership structure, for a variety of reasons. You know, maybe they didn't like the accounting outcomes, or they, you know, just the perceived risk of tax equity, they weren't comfortable with it. And so some of those groups that, you know, had previously not participated may participate with transferability, and we're starting to see that. There's also, you know, groups that I think will use it as a complement to their, you know, they're going to continue doing tax equity, but, you know, also potentially add some transferable credits to their portfolio. So I think it leads to additional capital coming into the space, which is, you know, critical. That's what we need. In terms of where that gets allocated, you know, the idea that it's going to really help smaller projects and like less credit worthy sponsors, I think is true to an extent, but maybe not as much as, you know, folks had hoped, because I think a lot of these new investors that are coming to the market that we're talking to still want scale, and they still want really strong sponsors on the other side of these transactions to, you know, provide them some guarantees and indemnities on the transaction. So, you know, the most attractive pricing in the transfer market is going to the largest sponsors with the, you know, strongest balance sheet, and that they can bring some scale. I think it will take some time, but I think, you know, there's the opportunity is there maybe to make that smaller end of the market more efficient. But it's still, I think if you're trying to market, you know, 1 million or a couple million dollars of credits by themselves, it's still pretty challenging, even with the transferability, to find groups that can, you know, transact on that smaller end. What we've been most focused on is, you know, portfolios of small projects, right? So each individual site might be small, but there's 30 or 40 of them. And though I think what the benefit we're looking at from transferability in those is, you know, getting to the financial closing is one thing, but then actually the administrative burden of all the fundings that come after that can be really challenging. So every one of those projects, as it reaches, you know, construction milestones, we have funding events associated with that. And our team, you know, every week is processing multiple, you know, fundings. So we're having to review these projects and where they are in their construction timelines, and have they achieved these milestones? And if yes, then we are calling capital from investors. And you know, for both us and the developers, it can be, you know, it can be a burdensome, you know, time intensive process to do that when you're talking about dozens of projects. So I think the idea that we could simplify that with transferability, because it's no, you know, it's no longer as critical for us to have our funds in by a certain date. It gives you a lot of flexibility, and you can potentially just, you know, maybe you just fund once a quarter or even just once a year or something like that to buy the credits on these portfolios. I think that, you know, definitely it's attractive to a lot of these sponsors in terms of the simplicity it would bring. The downside though is, you know, you probably give up something on the economics. You know, you're not monetizing the depreciation. And so, you know, some of these sponsors or developers can use some of the depreciation, but maybe not all. And so there's, you know, maybe some leakage of benefits there. And it also becomes, you know, more difficult potentially to establish a step up in their eligible basis on the projects. So, you know, like in a partnership flip transaction and tax equity, they typically will, you know, contribute the project into a partnership, and there's a appraisal that establishes a fair market value, and that, you know, there's a cost segregation report, but generally, you know, most of that fair market value is found eligible. And so they're able to, you know, effectively step up the value of that project to fair market value instead of just cost, and claim more credits that way. Doing that with a transfer is a little more complicated. I mean, essentially you need to, you know, I think groups are looking at doing that by selling a portion of their project. Maybe you sell 20 or 30% of your project and claim that, you know, that sale price is now, you know, the establishes a fair market value, and that you can transfer credits. But that hasn't really been as tested. And I think there's potentially more risk in that structure from the investor's perspective. And, you know, there's, I think, just a little bit more unease with that, that's going to, you know, what that's going to result in. And the IRS, with the guidance, you know, stating that there's this 120% penalty for an excessive transfer, I think that was, you know, a bit of a signal that, you know, don't push the things too far in terms of, you know, those step ups and what you're trying to transfer. And if you do, you know, there's a significant penalty that comes back at you. And so, you know, everyone's going in, I think, a little cautious about that. And those factors, plus the fact that, you know, it's just new, and a lot of this hasn't been set up yet. Thus far, we're seeing pretty much all of our community solar, you know, developers and sponsors still prioritizing tax equity, and then, you know, utilizing the transfer credit market, you know, where they can't find tax equity, but it, you know, still having a preference for tax equity when they can get it on the timelines that they need it. We've seen it play an interesting, there's, I think, a opportunity for them to kind of coexist though, even on the same deal. So as an example, we were looking at a portfolio where the ultimate goal is to raise tax equity, but they understand it's going to take them, you know, 60, 90 days or more to line up a tax equity investor. And in the meantime, in order to get access to lower cost funding from their construction lenders, they're lining up essentially a purchase agreement with us that, you know, will allow them to go to their lenders and say, hey, we've got someone lined up to purchase these credits, and so they can then borrow against that, and then they have an option to essentially terminate that purchase once they line up tax equity. So, you know, it could become a path to getting lenders comfortable with the monetization of these tax credits, and kind of a backup to the tax equity.
What's the buy-in for the buyer to be the backstop in this type of scenario?
Well, I think it's probably lower than market, you know, but because they have the idea is that, you know, they're likely not going to use it, and so it's more of a backstop.
So there's fees in there somewhere. I'm guessing.
The fees would be, yeah, there's a fee for terminating, right? So you terminate the purchase, you're paying a fee for that option, or you don't terminate and they get the credits at a favorable price.
That's the either or. Okay. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So just to close out our discussion here with a two-parter, how liquid has the transferability market gotten overall across all the different verticals, number one? And number two, there obviously has been other outfits setting up kind of, platforms, if you will, to, do the buy the trade, if that's something you guys are considering.
Yeah. So the question of how liquid is it? I think it's, there's a lot of interest. The IRA generally, I think, created a lot of just awareness among executive teams. It's at all these major companies that these credits are out there. So if they weren't already participating in some way, it was in their face. And then, yeah, there's just been an influx of new groups into the space, accounting firms, some of these new brokers and, even just sort of lone wolves that are out there trying to sling these credits. And so there's been a lot of outreach to a lot of these groups. And we're hearing from our clients that they're getting calls from a dozen different people trying to sell them transfer credits. So I think we are seeing, some new investors enter the market, some of them in a big way, like hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of tax credits. So that market is certainly growing. We don't have visibility into how large, but it's I think that there is a very significant expansion of the tax credit market that's happening. One thing that I guess I would say is, I think as an industry, we're going to kind of succeed or fail together in expanding this market to all these investors. And, hopefully, folks are being good actors in disclosing risks and structuring these things appropriately, because if we see some of these early buyers get burned, I think that will set the industry back significantly. And these transactions, even though, they're potentially simpler, are not without risk. And so I think it's important that we, are working with these buyers so that they understand the risks involved and those risks are being appropriately mitigated. And, if the buyer is working with a broker that's never done a tax credit transaction before, they might not know what they don't know. But so that's one area that, worries me a little bit. And so we're trying to do a lot of education, with our clients, and whether they choose to work with us or not, hopefully they're at least educated about these transactions and what the risks are. To your point, question about are we planning to set up a platform? I guess in a way I think we already are a platform for monetizing tax credits. We've been around for 40 years, and for a lot of our history, we were doing more just brokered transactions. It's only been in the last, 5 or 10 years that we've gone this fund model approach, where we secure commitments in the funds. And we have a very robust state tax credit business that it's pretty similar in a lot of ways to this transfer credit market. So, I'm looking at that state tax credit business as, kind of a roadmap to potentially how we participate here. So what that might look like, for example, instead of us, let's say, brokering a buyer direct into a purchase and just, earning a fee for referring them, I think the role we would like to play is more in setting up funds that will offer a, kind of full service approach to accessing these tax credits. So we would have a fund that, they can be a partner in, and then that fund on their behalf will be buying these tax credits, and they'll just be allocated the credits based on their, pro rata interest in the fund. And that's something we've done in the state credit market, and we found to be very efficient, on both sides, because sponsors and developers know that these, that FOSS fund is out there and has capacity, so they can you know, move forward in confidence with the projects. And the investors, you know, it makes it easy for them because they just set it up once and let us know what, you know, how many credits they want every year for the next X years. And then it's, you know, not a whole lot of additional work for them on a transaction by transaction basis. So that's kind of what, you know, I think our model looks like. It's not, you know, I don't see us setting up like a, you know, a marketplace per se. We're more, you know, the advisor is running the diligence. I think if you know, it's possible we'll transact through some of those portals, but I think, you know, the role that we'll play is working with those investors out there that, you know, would rather de-risk their transaction. They're okay paying a little bit more in order to have someone, you know, run a thorough diligence process and make sure that the risks have been mitigated.
Great. Well, Brian, that's about all the time we have. So thanks for joining the program today. Like I said earlier, he will be on the Project Financing Fireside Chat at the DGNYC conference next month with Radial Power CFO Ed Kent, Andy Redinger of KeyBank, and the panel will be moderated by Vaughn Morrison of Troutman Pepper. That panel is slated for 3:10 p.m. EST on October 11th. Please check out newprojectmedia.com for more information on this event. Thanks again, Brian. Appreciate your time. Please tune in next time. Burke out.